Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here, there can be no denying. One of us is changing, or maybe we just stopped trying. And it's too late, baby, now it's too late, though we really did.
Hello. This is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from sources that have rock and roll articles in it. This includes Parade Magazine, ClassicBands.com, BGORecords.com, ClassicRock.about.com, TheNewsAndObserver.com, The Associated Press, TheRollingStone.com, and Financial Times. This opening is brought to us by Carol King. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. We'll be hearing more from Carol King and about Carol King later on in today's program. This opening is It's Too Late. But first, these trivia questions. The first trivia question today comes to us from Parade Magazine, published on the 4th of October, 2009. Question is, which rock group sang Stairway to Heaven? Big hint here that it's a trick question, since there were two very different songs with this exact same name. One group recorded a song with this title back in 1971. The second group recorded a different song with the same title back in 1975. So name one of these two groups that sang Stairway to Heaven back in the 1970s. The second trivia question is brought to us by ClassicBands.com. Who sang that? I'll give the title. You give me the singer. Name of the song? Blueberry Hill. Who sang it? Big hint here, it reached number 2 back in 1957. The answers to these two trivia questions will be given at the end of today's program. But first, these transitions. Our transitions are brought to us once again by BGO Records from their article entitled Today in Rock History, and today is February 13 and February 14. What were the number one hits back in history on this weekend? Well, back in 1968, it was The Mighty Quinn by Manfred Mann. And the number one hit back in 1970? Sly and the Family Stone, Thank You. 1987, this weekend, it was Bon Jovi, Living on a Prayer. And back in 1999, it was Lenny Kravitz, Fly Away. If you were born on February 13th, you share a birthday with Tennessee Ernie Ford, 16 tons. He was born in 1919 on February 13th. More recently, 1946, Peter Tork of the Monkees was born on February 13th. Back in 1950, it was Peter Gabriel, Sledgehammer, born on February 13th. And 1952, Edward John Gagliardi from Foreigner, born on February 13th. If you were born on February 14th, you share a birthday with Vic Briggs of the Animals. He was born on February 14th, 1945. Also on February 14th, 1947, Tim Buckley, U.S. singer and songwriter. Rock miscellany this weekend, well, back in 1958, Iran bans all rock and roll music. And back in 1964, this weekend, it was the Dave Clark Five releasing Bits and Pieces in the UK with advanced sales of 250,000. Back in 1972, this weekend, it was Grease, the musical, opening on Broadway. Back in that same year, 1972, this weekend, it was John and Yoko beginning a week-long stint on U.S. TV as co-host of The Mike Douglas Show. Highlights include appearance by Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry, according to John Lennon, is my hero. 1974, Bob Dylan tour ends at the Forum, Los Angeles. Ringo Starr, Carole King, and Neil Young join him on stage. Much of Before the Flood album is recorded here. Back in 1982, on these dates in February, it was Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon celebrating 402 weeks in the U.S. Top 200 LP chart, longest run in chart history. Back in 1988, this weekend, it was John Cougar Mellencamp's The Lonesome Jubilee achieved certified sales of 2 million. And finally, back in 1988, during this time in February, Michael Jackson buys Neverland, a ranch in Santa Ynez, California. This next article is brought to us by classicrock.about.com, written by Dave White, entitled Black History in Classic Rock, Celebrating the African-American Influence. African-American musicians have long been associated with jazz, blues, hip-hop, and soul music, but there is also much to celebrate about their influence on classic rock. Our great respect and gratitude for these artists as we celebrate Black History Month in February. Would it involve Jimi Hendrix Electric described more than just the kind of guitar he used? It described his stage presence, his personal life, and his influence on rock. The list of artists who point to Hendrix as a major influence would fill several pages. A very small sample would include Eddie Van Halen, Peter Frampton, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Ted Nugent, and Steve Lukather. He first came to America's notice when he played the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. He secured musical immortality with his hard rock rendition of the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock in 1969. Billy Preston's notoriety as the fifth Beatle was well earned. The label on the single version of Get Back lists the performer as the Beatles with Billy Preston, making him the only artist ever to get that kind of marquee billing on a Beatles release. He was a keyboard prodigy, having started playing piano at age 3, and began recording gospel albums when he was 16. Although his collaboration with the Beatles was his most famous, he also worked with a long list of artists that included the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, Elton John, Bob Dylan, and Eric Burdon. His catalog also included nearly 30 solo albums recorded between 1962 and 2001. He died of kidney failure in 2006. Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton are among the guitarists who have proudly professed that their work was strongly influenced by electric blues legend Buddy Guy. A consummate showman, Guy has been known to play with a guitar over his head behind his back with drumsticks or while cavorting with the audience. He performed with Clapton and Cream bandmate Jack Bruce, Stephen Stills, and Led Zeppelin for a 1969 British film, Super Show, a documentary about blues rock. In an interview with Musician magazine, the usually taciturn Clapton said, "Buddy Guy is by far and without a doubt the best guitar player alive. If you see him in person, the way he plays is beyond anyone. He really changed the course of rock and roll blues." Hendrix, Guy, and Clapton are among the many who cite electric blues master B.B. King as a primary influence. King ranks third, behind Hendrix and Duane Allman, on Rolling Stone's list of the 100 greatest guitarists of all time. Now in his 80s, King still performs occasionally at events like Clapton's Crossroads Festival in 2007 and the Bonnaroo Music and Arts Festival in 2008. It is estimated that he has played more than 15,000 live performances over the course of more than 50 years. To say that folk rocker Ritchie Havens was a good choice to open the Woodstock Festival in 1969 would be an understatement. The crowd gave him a nearly continuous standing ovation throughout his performances, and he stopped doing encores only because he ran out of songs. His distinctive guitar work and soulful vocals have put him in high demand since he began working his way through the Greenwich Village coffee houses circuit, along with Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, in the mid-60s. He is still recording. Nobody Left to Crown was released in 2008, and performing. In 2009, he returned to the site of the original Woodstock Festival for a 40th anniversary performance at Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. Several others that Dave White details in his article include the following. Clarence Clemens, saxophonist for Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band. Jaimo Johannesson. He's a drummer with the Allman Brothers Band. Sam Clayton, percussionist and vocalist for Little Feat. And Lonnie Jorday, keyboardist for Eric Burden's War. In local rock news, we see this article by David Menconi, published back in December 20th, 2009, entitled All About Carolina Music. Kannapolis. If that old real estate axiom of location, location, location truly counts for anything, the NC Music Hall of Fame will be a success someday. It's immediately adjacent to the big bronze statue of the late Dale Earnhardt, the iconic NASCAR legend and Kannapolis native. Yeah, we get some accidental visitors, Eddie Ray says with a laugh. Racing fans who are here to see the Earnhardt statue and wonder what's going on next door with the music. Those people tend to be country music fans. There's been a vision of the NC Music Hall of Fame since the late 1990s when it originated 50 miles up the road in Thomasville. But the hall was inactive for most of the past decade until Ray, who serves as operations director and vice chairman, and record executive Mike Kerb revived it and moved it to the former jailhouse of the old Kannapolis Village. Kerb, a former lieutenant governor of California, bankrolled both the music hall and the nearby Kerb Motorsports Museum. 6 months after opening in Kannapolis, the NC Music Hall of Fame remains a modest work in progress. Most of the enshrined acts are represented by little more than pictures on the walls. Until it is more to show off, one of the hall's rooms is given over to displays of acts with no connection to North Carolina, including Tim McGraw, Leanne Rimes, and Garth Brooks, who are all signed to Kerb Records. Well, this is where we are at the present time, Ray says. Come back in 6 months, and we hope there'll be more of it. Chosen by the board. Ray has ambitious plans for the hall, which only has exhibits on the ground floor for now. There's plenty of room to expand upstairs, where Ray would like to someday see a digital archive with music and interviews. A native of Franklin, Ray is credited with co-writing Hearts of Stone, a multi-format smash in the mid-1950s for the Charms, Fontaine Sisters, and Red Foley. He later worked as an executive at Capitol Records, where he signed a young Mike Kerb to a record deal in 1964. MGM Records and Stax Publishing before serving as commissioner of the U.S. Copyright Tribunal under President Reagan. A 7-member board decides which artists get into the hall, and the most recent round was inducted in October. Some of the artifacts include stage outfits worn by Thomasville Dixie Diva, opera singer Victoria Livingood, Gold's record and other memorabilia from Marshland's Randy Travis, and a fiddle and hat donated by Wilmington's Charlie Daniels. Tar Heel natives Donna Fargo, Roberta Flack, Andy Griffith, and Loman Pauling of Winston-Salem's Five Royals also have displays, but there are a few artists whose connections to North Carolina are a bit tenuous. Archie Bell of Tighten Up fame is actually from Houston, but he lives in the Charlotte area. So he's in, represented by an electric blue suit from his collection of stage attire. And South Carolina native Dizzy Gillespie is in because he attended the Laurinburg Institute in North Carolina for 2 years. Who's missing? As for missing artists, Elizabeth Cotton, Doc Watson, Shirley Caesar, Mitch Easter, Arthur Smith, the DBs, and Squirrel Nut Zippers are still nowhere in evidence. So far, the hall is also missing out on a potential big draw in that it is nothing on any of North Carolina's many American Idol finalists, Chris Daugherty, Clay Aiken, Kelly Pickler, or even 2004 season winner Fantasia Barrino. It's going to take us a while to catch up, Ray says, so we're starting with a lot of the older posthumous musicians, the Thelonious Monks and John Coltranes and Kate Smiths. There's one other curious oversight. George Clinton was inducted this past October, but the museum still doesn't have a display for him, which is surprising because, like Earnhardt, he's a native of Kannapolis. We haven't been able to get him to send us any memorabilia yet, Ray says, but we're working on it. Give us time. This next article was published newsandobserver.com on the 25th of January, 2010, entitled German Rock Band Scorpions to End Career. Berlin. The German rock band Scorpions is bringing down the curtain on a career spanning more than four decades. The band, known for its early 1990s hit, Wind of Change, among others, said on its website Sunday that, "We agree we have reached the end of the road." It said it would end its career with a final album, Sting in the Tail, to be released in March, and a tour that will start in Germany in May and take it across the world over the next few years. Guitarist Rudolf Schenker founded the band in Hanover in 1965. Singer Klaus Meine joined a few years later. Both men are now 61 years old. This next article is by Emily Stokes and was published in the Financial Times on the 19th of January, 2010. Marianne Faithfull, who opened at the Lincoln Center in New York, half an hour into her performance to launch the American Songbook Series at the Lincoln Center, Marianne Faithfull took a red lipstick out of her pocket and applied it to her lips, her gaze fixed on the audience. "You are my mirror," she said with much gravitas in her posh, gravelly voice. After so many turbulent decades in the public eye, Faithfull knows that she can't do mumsy. Instead, she likes to play the patron saint of celebrity, sacrificing her life for our entertainment. "This is the best night of my life," she continued, and she did look fabulous against the Columbus Square skyline, dressed in a silk bomber jacket with lace ruffs that only slightly constricted her dancing, a punky Elizabeth the One. Her opening number, Barry Reynolds' Times Square, set the tone, which was only loosely American and a little off the rails. "If alcohol could take me there, I'd take a shot a minute." Her voice is wrecked but powerful, and the Decemberist Crane Wife 3 from her 2008 cover album, Easy Come, Easy Go, showed how very low it could go. At the start of Broken English, her 1979 rant against terrorism, she gesticulated wildly at the band, crying, "Come on, faster," as if challenging them to drown her out. They couldn't. The pace slowed with the inevitable rendition of As Tears Go By, that folksy 1964 single by Jagger and Richards that launched her career. "It's a sweet moment, isn't it?" she barked, with a hint of irony. But the audience wasn't allowed to bathe in comfortable nostalgia. After the initial high, Faithfull was tired. She had a nasty, rattling cough. American songs led to panic. She froze after a few bars of Miss Otis Regrets. Judy Sills' The Phoenix was tense. It was only when she returned to her old standards that we could relax a little, or rather focus, on the task at hand. A 63-year-old, proudly rapping the explicit lyrics of "Why'd You Do It?" Returning to the stage for an encore, she shook her head. "You clap and I come," she said wistfully. "So it has been and always will be." As she wrote in her 1994 autobiography, Faithfull, "All celebrities become burlesque of themselves in the end." Well, what do you know about Carole King, the artist who opened today's program and will close it as well? Well, this biography comes to us from RollingStone.com, from the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll, Simon & Schuster, 2001. Singer-songwriter Carole King has had two outstanding careers. Throughout the 1960s, she was one of pop's most prolific songwriters, writing the music to songs like the Shirelles' "Will You Love Me Tomorrow?" and the Drifters' "Up on the Roof," with most lyrics by her first husband, Jerry Goffin. Then in 1971, her multi-million-selling Tapestry helped popularize the 70s pop-rock singer-songwriter genre. King began playing piano at age 4. In high school, she started her first band, the Cosines. While attending Queens College in 1958, she met Jeffrey Goffin, and the two became co-writers. King had written some early singles like Going Wild and Babysittin', but they went nowhere. Neil Sedaka had a hit dedicated to her in October 1959 called O Carol, but her reply song O Neil stiffed. In 1961, she and Goffin co-wrote Will You Love Me Tomorrow, a number one hit for the Shirelles, and the song has been covered countless times since. The two young writers, like Sedaka, Cynthia Weil, and Barry Mann, wrote their songs for Don Kirshner and Al Nevins, Alden Music, and Brill Building Cubicles. They wrote over 100 hits in a range of rock styles, including Wasn't Born to Follow, The Birds, Chains, The Cookies, Don't Bring Me Down, The Animals, and I'm Into Something Good, Herman's Hermits. In 1962, the King Goffin team wrote, arranged, conducted, and produced the song, The Locomotion, for their 17-year-old babysitter, Little Eva Boyd, and it went number one that summer. That year, King made a brief foray into solo recording, but her only single at the time was It Might As Well Rain Until September, where it reached number 22. James Taylor, You've Got a Friend, which also appeared on King's Tapestry, encouraged her to write her own lyrics and finally record solo again, resulting in 1970s records. They worked on the 1971 critical and commercially windfall Tapestry, which had two hit singles, It's Too Late, reached number one in 1971. That's the song that opened today's program. And So Far Away reached number 14 in 1971. We'll hear a snippet from that in just a minute. Won four Grammys, went number one, and stayed on the chart for nearly 6 years. It remains a solid catalog performer and now sold 22 million copies. King's early 1970s LPs went gold in top 10. Music and Wrap Around the Joy both hit number one, and in 1974 she had a number two hit with Jazz Man from Wrap Around Joy. In 1975, King wrote the music for a children's program, Really Rosie, and began to write with Goffin again. She switched to Capitol Records in late 1976, and her first album for the new label, Simple Things, number 17 in 1977, went gold. She began touring with a band called Navarro, introduced to her by Dan Fogelberg, and married her collaborator at the time, Rick Evers, who died of a heroin overdose in 1978. Involved in environmental issues since the 1980s, the songwriter was honored at the 1999 star-studded event, Carole King, Making Music with Friends, a Concert for Our Children, Our Health, and Our Planet. The following year, she was a guest on fellow Brill Building songwriter Barry Mann's album, Soul and Inspiration. King's music remains an essential part of America's pop consciousness. In 1993, the Off-Broadway Review, Tapestry, The Music of Carole King, evoked the songwriter's biggest hits, a tribute albums. 1995, Tapestry Revisited featured singers such as Celine Dion, Faith Hill, Rod Stewart, and Richard Marx performing songs from King's enduring 1971 record. According to this article published in NewsObserver.com on January 12, 2010, Carole King and James Taylor will reunite for a U.S. tour. In the four decades since James Taylor and Carole King helped launch each other's storied careers, the notion of someday recapturing that magic never completely faded. Every time we would run into each other at a benefit or at an event, we'd say, we have to get the band back together, get that band back together and do some touring before the chance slips away, Taylor said in a recent interview. On Monday, Taylor and King announced dates for the U.S. leg of their much-anticipated Troubadour reunion tour. The tour, marking the 40th anniversary of the pair's breakthrough shows, will launch May 7th in Portland, Oregon. King played on Taylor's 1970s Sweet Baby James album, and Taylor played on King's 1971 Tapestry album. So let's listen to some snippets in from Carole King, and we'll end up today's program with the James Taylor album that Carole King helped on. But first, these from Carole King, So Far Away, I Feel the Earth Move, And then one of our children's songs, Chicken Soup with Rice, before we end up today's program with Fire and Rain by James Taylor.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. It doesn't help to know you're just time away. Long ago I reached for you and there you stood.
Now a snippet from my Fill the Earth move. Snippet from her children's rock song called Chicken Soup with Rice.
In January it's so nice, while slipping on the slide in ice, to sip hot chicken soup with rice. Sipping once, sipping twice, chicken soup with rice. In February it will be my snowman's anniversary, with cake for him and soup for me. Happy once, happy twice, happy chicken soup with rice. In March the wind blows down the door and spills my soup.
And once again we'll end up with today's program, Fire and Rain by James Taylor, the album that Carole King helped him with. But first, this review of a recent album by Animal Collective called Fall Be Kind, given 4 stars out of a possibility of 5, and printed in The Week, December 25, 2009 through January 8, 2010. Fall Be Kind plays like a chilled outside 3 to Meriwether Post Pavilion, the album released earlier this year by the KG Hippies of Animal Collective, said Stephen Hayden in The Onion. Featuring just 5 songs, this EP proves a worthy epilogue to an all-time classic. The trip begins with Graze, a technicolor swirl of a song. It floats by with Noah Lennox's echoing vocals and crescendoing strings before gently easing into a jaunty electro-polka jig. As odd as all that sounds, the song works, says Mark Richardson in PitchforkMedia.com. Graze flows directly into What Would I Want, Sky? Which weaves in the Grateful Dead's Unbroken Chain, the first sample that band has officially licensed. It may have been the Dead's smartest marketing move since the band greenlighted Cherry Garcia ice cream. The song sounds as natural as something that grew out of the earth, and Animal Collective seems wonderfully at ease as its year of crossover success comes to a close. The band can look back at 2009 and wave its freak flag high. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. program is available as a podcast.